Of anything after lunch. Ellis Connolly, head of payments policy at the Reserve Bank, speaking with the Australian Financial Review's senior writer, James Ayres.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Ellis, for joining us.
Thanks very much, James.
Ellis has been in his role for about 2 years running payment policy at the Reserve Bank, and there's a lot of issues going on in payments, as we've been hearing this morning already. So I wanted to start there. If I could, as James said in his introduction, we've got some issues about cash and cash in transit, which we'll get to second. But I wanted to start on the issue of digital platforms. Now, we have a piece of legislation that is in the federal parliament at the moment, ladies and gentlemen, the Payment System Reform Act, and it hasn't been passed yet, but it will give the Reserve Bank more powers alongside the Treasurer to designate different digital platforms as payment systems. Ellis, I wondered if you might just be able to explain to us the context of those new powers and how urgent is it in the bank's eyes for those to be received?
Thanks very much. First, I'd want to emphasise that Australia's payment system actually does function pretty well on a global standard. Nevertheless, there have been some significant changes to the landscape, a lot more complexity in the payments landscape than there was when the Payment System Regulation Act was first introduced back in 1998. Back then, it was a pretty simple world. There were card schemes, there were issuers, there were acquirers, and the PSRA was fit for purpose for regulating those sorts of entities. These days, it's much more complicated. As you know, there are new platforms that are transforming the payments experience, and there's lots of new players in the ecosystem as well, from fintechs through to big techs. So from our perspective, the reforms that the government's introduced, which will broaden the scope of the RBA's regulatory powers to include these new platforms, these new players, is really important to enable the RBA to continue to promote the safety, efficiency and competitiveness of Australia's payment system.
So presuming this law is passed, I'm not sure when that will be, what is it that you might be able to do with the powers? Like, could you run us through some examples of some potential interventions? Not talking about companies specifically, but what's the sort of stuff that you're able to do once you're armed with these new powers?
Well, the first thing we're planning to do once the legislation passes is launch a comprehensive review of retail payments regulation in Australia to enable all stakeholders to engage and let us know what you see as the issues in Australia's payment system. There are a few themes, a few focus areas that are already emerging. One of those is mobile wallets, another one is the cost of payments, and another one is surcharging. On mobile wallets, we really have seen Australians embrace the use of mobile wallets for payments. In the data we collect, over a third of card payments are now going through mobile wallets. At the same time, we can see that some efficiency and competitiveness issues are arising, particularly around the access to the underlying technology for competing digital wallet providers, and also around the transparency of the fees being charged by some mobile wallet providers. On the issue of the cost of payments, we know from the data we collect, small businesses pay a lot more than large businesses for payment services. This suggests that there may be some inefficiencies in the Australian payment system here. It's also a challenge for the broader competitiveness of the Australian economy. So we really are keen to look at what further can be done to help reduce the cost of payments for small businesses. And then on surcharging, there is quite a lot of community concern around card surcharging at the moment. So we think it is time for us to do a comprehensive review of whether our framework is still fit for purpose.
Just to go into a little bit more detail on that point on surcharging. So when you imposed your surcharging rules, which allows merchants to surcharge the cost of credit card payments, cash was the main way that most people paid. So I suppose a buyer of goods could decide to use cash and avoid the surcharge, but as more payments are being made electronically, that option, you know, some people don't even have a physical wallet with cash in it, I mean, most people probably, it's harder to avoid the surcharge. So I suppose it raises questions about whether or not there should be a surcharge at all, does it? Or what are you planning on looking at in that
review?
These
are exactly, the things that have changed. So if you go back to the early 2000s when we originally enabled merchants to be able to surcharge card payments, back then, well over half, I mean, I think in the data we collected in 2007, almost 70% of payments were in cash. It's hard to believe these days, looking back on it, that that's how we were paying, but it was. So back then, the surcharging regime we put in place, we thought made very good sense. It enabled merchants to have a bit more bargaining power when they were speaking with their payment service providers, basically going, you know, if you charge me those rates, I'm going to need to surcharge the customers. It also helped to put some pressure on the card schemes to keep their costs low. It also provided a signal to consumers to use a cheaper payments method, which back then indeed was cash. Times have changed. The use of cash has declined dramatically. In the latest data we collected, it's down to 13% of consumer payments are made in cash, compared to that 70% back in 2007. At the same time, card payments, it's the way people pay. The 3/4 of payments are using cards. Half of payments are using debit cards. So circumstances have changed. We've seen a bit more use of surcharging as well. You probably all see them in cafes and restaurants quite often as well. And an increased use of the same surcharge across the board, whether it's a debit card or a credit card. What this means for the many consumers who aren't walking around with cash in their wallets anymore, and in the survey we ran a couple of years ago, 30% of consumers indicated that they didn't have any cash in their wallets anymore. They really feel they can't avoid the surcharge because any card they use is going to be surcharged in that circumstance. So it is time for a review of this. All options are on the table, including potentially placing some limits on surcharging. For instance, given the extent to which debit cards are now the most frequently used means of payment, is it time for debit card payments to be surcharge-free? These are the sorts of questions we're going to ask. We're going to try and reduce the frustration for customers at the same time as retaining some of those benefits of surcharging for merchants and the broader payment system.
While we're talking about implications of the declining use of cash, Ellis, I was just interested in the role that the Reserve Bank is playing to help solve the short-term financial pressures on Armaguard and the cash and transit industry. I've heard a little bit about that already this morning, and also to develop like a longer-term structure for this industry. How urgent is this issue in your mind?
So the RBA places a high priority on Australians continuing to have reasonable access to cash services. So late last year, the Governor of the Reserve Bank convened some industry discussions about the challenges with the access to cash, particularly around the viability of cash in transit services. We've heard today from Anna Bly on how those discussions are going, and also from Gina Cascott-Lee as well. So you've had quite a good update along with your article in the AFR, James. So there's not much I can comment on in terms of the negotiations that are going on. What I can say is that we place a high priority on this. Finding long-term solutions here, it's a complex challenge in a declining cash environment. It's going to take time. The governor has encouraged all of the participants in the cash distribution industry to approach these issues with the public interest in mind.
Okay. Thank you for that. Another issue on your plate is looming sort of changes to the payment licensing regimes for payment providers. And as I understand it, the sort of basic push here is to encourage more fintechs and payment providers to be directly connected into the Australian payment system in a more pro-competitive environment. Could you just talk us through how you're seeing that? You know, what risks there might be by more connections and more providers? So it sounds like a broader number of players will be coming inside your regulatory remit. And the extent to which you're wanting to see more competition at that payment provider level with these licensing reforms.
Yeah, we're very strongly supportive of the government's plans to introduce a payment service provider license to enable non-banks to be able to get direct access to some of Australia's key payment systems. At the moment, when these non-banks are having to compete, if they want to try and get their customer funds transferred, they need to use a bank as an intermediary to be able to access Australia's payment system.
Or in the case of Wise, become a bank themselves.
The alternative is to actually get an ADI license and go through that full process. So the idea here is to have a more fit for purpose, targeted payment service provider license, which is not quite the full ADI style license, given that many of these entities are not engaging in the full set of services that a bank provides.
They're not lending.
For instance, that's right. So we think there's a lot of promise in that. What it can do, a well-designed payment service provider license can give the confidence to the operators of payment systems that these non-banks can directly participate and transact in the payment system without injecting lots of risk into it. And that's because a well-designed license will help to ensure that those payment service providers are appropriately managing, say, their financial and operational risks. So we think this is, it's very promising. It could help to increase competition and innovation in the payment system, and the end beneficiaries will be customers and merchants who will hopefully receive lower prices and better services.
By bypassing the institutional banks?
Through more competition.
Yeah.
And also quite often it's in fintechs that come up with great new ideas.
Okay. Another thing that's looming is the end at the end of this decade, which is 6 years away. So we're getting a little bit of ahead of ourselves here, but there's a bit of work to do, I think.
On the payment system. 2030 is like tomorrow in the payment system.
Yeah. So the end of BECCS, ladies and gentlemen, which is the bulk electronic clearing system. So this is the workhorse of the payment system. It processes the vast majority of debit payments, your salaries, superannuation contributions, all the overnight batch processing. It's old system. In the last few years, the banks have built new debit infrastructure called the New Payments Platform, just a real-time system. There's some volumes going over the NPP at the moment. The plan is for the BECCS volumes to eventually shift that way. But what more uplift do we need to see in the NPP in order to get this BECCS volume onto this new infrastructure within 5 years, say? How much work is there to do to hit those industry targets?
Yeah, I mean, there is plenty of work to do. The NPP infrastructure itself will need to be able to handle the much greater volumes, and that is something that the industry is working on. Some of the new functionality that is required to be able to transfer a lot of the volume from BECCS to NPP, for instance, relies on a new service called Pay2. Pay2 will enable the modernisation of direct debits in Australia. It'll give customers much more control over their recurring payments. You'll actually be able to see them in your banking app and decide which ones you want to continue with. It'll also enable third parties to initiate payments, actually getting quite a lot of the benefits of CDR action initiation up and running.
So what do the major banks need to be doing on Pay2? Like, I get the impression that there's not a lot of push out of Pay2 into the utility or institutional sort of customer base of the banks who are big billers.
It's a slow rollout. Been a slow
Does
rollout.
Does it need to be faster?
There is more work to be done here. So it's got to the point where the major banks in particular have connected their customer accounts, but what we need to see is enablement across all of the key channels. So internet banking on and also in-app banking as well. We also need to see more connection of business customers to this, particularly to be able to initiate the payments. So there's quite a bit of work still to be done there. And then there's also the promotion of the service to business customers. So we would really like to see the banks taking full advantage of this.
And obviously Visa and MasterCard debit schemes are the dominant networks for processing debit payments as well as FPOS. But as you move more payments into the NPP, which is domestic debit real-time infrastructure, do you envisage any kind of blowback or resistance from Visa and MasterCard? How are they sort of viewing this encouragement by you of more volume into the national infrastructure?
So the international card schemes have interchange arrangements which do encourage the participation of issuers. Equivalent to this, there's a modest interchange-like fee, interchange-like payment associated now with the NPP, which can also encourage the banks to participate there. Our perspective on this is very much that the same rules with regard to pricing and competition apply to the international schemes as apply to domestic schemes such as the NPP. Specifically in the case of interchange, our long-standing view on this is that interchange should not be set at a level which impedes the efficiency or competitiveness of the Australian payment system. Now, as long as everyone's playing by on that same level playing field, then we think competition between the schemes should help to generate better outcomes for consumers and merchants.
Should. Another topic, which is the consumer data right and open banking. Now, we heard from Gina Cascott-Lieb in her speech just before lunch that the ACCC is encouraging of the CDR and is even looking to take more enforcement action against banks to make sure that the quality of the data is up to scratch. We heard from Matt Common a little bit earlier that perhaps, you know, the banks had over-invested or had spent a lot in open banking and weren't yet seeing the benefits of that, and he raised business banking as an area where he thought that it could have some productive use, but we're sort of still waiting to get that off the ground. What do you feel about the open banking policy and specifically the intention to extend it into the merchant acquiring space? So this is payment terminals that sit on the in retailers, on the merchant retailer side. That's a proposal to extend it. Would that be useful for the Reserve Bank if that did indeed happen?
Oh, we think that would be very, very helpful. I mean, in general, CDR, open banking, we're very supportive of that to help encourage more competition in the banking system. It also has implications for the payment system. One avenue of it is action initiation, enabling third parties to be able to, for instance, trigger payments. Actually, Pay2 delivers quite a few of those benefits, which is great. Another area that, as you highlight, James, we think is very promising would be open banking for acquiring services. We really think that could help small businesses make best use of their acquiring data to shop around and get a better deal on their payment costs.
Okay. We've just got one more minute. I've just got one more question, and this is on the future of money. And the Reserve Bank has been working for a couple of years now on central bank digital currency. Should banks be preparing, Ellis, for a world where they're providing payments on blockchain-based systems that allow for the atomic settlement of real-world assets that have been tokenized onto the blockchain, potentially facilitated by a wholesale EAUD backed by the Reserve Bank?
Well, that question just rolled off the tongue, didn't it? Anyway, so...
I've just got a wonk. It's a last question, so...
Yeah, it's a good one. So it's really up to the banks in terms of what infrastructure they want to invest in. You know, options include blockchain for tokenised assets. And we maintain an open mind as to what role a CBDC could play in the settlement of those assets. We ran a CBDC pilot last year, and we saw there was a lot of interest in industry for the use case where a CBDC would be supporting the settlement of tokenized assets. We can see some benefits from tokenization in terms of speeding up settlement, reducing settlement risk, making it more efficient. At the same time, there's potentially risks, particularly operational risks, around blockchains that would need to be managed. So our next research project in this space is going to explore whether different forms of digital money could help to support the settlement of tokenized assets. We're looking forward as part of this project to engaging with industry again. We learn a lot from industry on what benefits these new technologies could potentially have for Australia's financial system.
Well, we're right on time. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Ellis. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, James.
Well, one of the biggest challenges and opportunities facing businesses is the transition to net zero. A critical enabler of that transition, of course, are the lenders, a group under increasing pressure to align their own loan books with the economy's net zero targets. So how is that balance being achieved, and what are the conversations being had with clients? To delve into the issue, very pleased to welcome to the